My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by Tim Carpenter, former FBI lead investigator for the ARC crime team, who has written an excellent book called The Grave Robber, which looks at the unbelievable true story of how one man stole thousands of priceless artifacts and human remains from around the world. It is a slightly grisly story, but a very interesting one, and we dive into how the FBI investigates ARC crime. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Tim, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on. How are you doing?
Yeah, thanks. I'm doing well. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you on. For the benefit of the listeners, please can you just tell us sort of a little bit about yourself and how you came to focus on ARC crime within the FBI?
Yeah, happy to do it. I think probably most of your guests would say their stories are a bit strange. Mine's that way. I grew up in a small town in East Tennessee, and you might detect that from my accent. So most people, when they hear me start talking about ARC crime, they're like, wait a minute, where are you from? So they don't quite get it. But I grew up in the 70s and the 80s. Like most kids, I wanted to be a musician and an artist. And so I was studying to go to art school, but this little thing called Desert Storm happened, right? So the war started. And, I think like most kids that era, also coming off of the hills of Top Gun, I wanted to be a fighter pilot like Tom Cruise and all that great stuff, So I enlisted in the military instead. And so my life, of course, took a little bit of a different turn. And I actually became a bomb technician. So I was an explosive ordnance disposal technician, disarming bombs for a living. And so when I got out of the military, it was like, well, what do I do now? I don't really know how to do anything else. So law enforcement was a natural progression, for me, go be on the bomb squad kind of thing. But it's strange because like unlike most FBI agents, or many, I should say, many FBI agents that grow up wanting to be FBI agents, that was never on my radar. It just kind of progressed that way, right? It fell into my lap as I went through my law enforcement career and ended up in the FBI, which was a blessing in disguise. And at that time, like most, I didn't even know that the FBI investigated art and cultural property crimes. And so when I came into the organization as a young agent and was trying to get my feet under me, I started to hear a little bit about these cases. And then I was actually out on, I was just supporting a case for another agent in the office on a historical case. And, you know, so I realized, oh, the FBI does this kind of work. And I threw my hand up and basically kind of bullied my way into it. It's like, I'm going to take all those cases. And the rest is history, as they say.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, what drew you to write this great book, The Grave Robber? And how did you go about researching it and reconstructing the story?
Yeah, so this this was a seminal case for not only for me personally, but for the FBI's art crime team. So, you know, the team was created officially late 2004, early 2005, and it was created under the auspices of being this rapid deployment art crime team, right? It was really in response to the looting of the Iraqi National Museum at Baghdad, you know, when Congress looked at the FBI and said, what are you guys going to do about this? So at the time, the Bureau knew that they needed to create this kind of organic expertise in the agency. And the concept was to have the ability to pick up this trained, dedicated team and put them on the ground somewhere to work these types of investigations. But in 2014 or late 2013, when the Miller case came along our radar, the team had never been tested in that way. And so this was really a seminal moment for the program. Of, it was the first time that we were able to exercise this concept of deploying this group of folks with this expertise. But so, you know, the Miller case happened, and it was strange because I had moved to Indiana. I had been transferred to Indiana to the Indianapolis field office from Miami. And you can imagine in Miami, I was quite busy on the art crime front. When I went to Indiana, I kind of thought, well, there goes my art crime career. I really didn't think there was a lot of work there related to art and cultural property. And I was pleasantly surprised. I couldn't have been more wrong. It's got a great, vibrant cultural center there in Indianapolis. But lo and behold, you know, a year or two into that assignment, and this case landed in my lap, literally just kind of fell out of nowhere. And like most cases, it started pretty mundane. It was just a pretty minor tip that came in. But as we started to, you know, tug on the thread, if you will, and unfold this great investigation, it became kind of the largest investigation that the FBI had ever done related to cultural property. And so you can imagine then the media attention that we got. It was a lot of public attention, a lot of media attention to this case, not only at the time, but really persisted for years as we worked through the repatriation process and all of that. And so, and I'm a long answer to your question about why did I write the book? It was really to kind of set the record straight, right? There was a lot of misreporting, as you can imagine, that tends to happen with the media. A lot of focus on Don Miller himself and kind of the crimes that Don committed, because there's always this fascination with true crime, right? People are interested in those things. But for me, the story was never really about Don Miller and his crimes. The story was about the impact that those crimes had on the communities that were affected by it, right? Indigenous communities, and this concept of manifest destiny and all of these kind of things that we've been getting wrong for hundreds of years. And this was an opportunity for us to set things right a little bit. So that's what drew me to write this book, was to tell the story in the right way and to recognize the harm that was committed.
Yeah, brilliant. And what are the kind of bigger questions you hope the book would explore about sort of history, ethics, and the FBI's role in protecting culture?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I kind of just touched on that, right? It's this concept of manifest destiny, particularly in Western cultures, you know, where we think just because we came and we conquered, we're entitled to it, which is, you know, utter nonsense, really. And, you know, if you look at a subject like Don Miller, it's easy, of course, to try to cast him as some kind of an evil person or a monster and all of these things, but that's not true. Don Miller was just a man. He was a product of his era, I think. When you consider that he was born in the 20s, you know, he grew up in the 30s and the 40s. You think about that, right? His grandfather was of the era where they fought in the last of the Indian Wars here in the United States, right? And so you can kind of, maybe if you step back and look at that holistically, you could see that he was just a product of his environment, a product of his era, where they, you know, they looked poorly upon indigenous communities here in the United States. And so this was an opportunity, I think, for us to highlight that and to demonstrate to your listeners and demonstrate to the readers of the book that this kind of activity is not okay, right? Morally and ethically, it's not okay. It's pretty offensive, this concept that we could go along and dig up people's ancestors and dig up graves, take their belongings, take their bodies and take them home and stick them on our shelves, right? That's not, that's not the way that, it's not the way we should do things. And so I think ultimately at its core, this is not even really an art crime case or a cultural property case. This is a human rights case, right? This is about the basic dignity of human beings that when we're buried, somebody's not going to come along 50 years later and dig us up, take us home as a trophy, right?
Yeah, one would hope not. It's not a very nice thought, is it?
No.
So just changing tack slightly. So I want to have a quick look at the FBI crime team, because obviously we've got listeners who are very much interested in sort of law enforcement and the kind of nuts and bolts of it. So for listeners unfamiliar, what is the FBI art team exactly, and why does the Bureau have one, and what kind of, you know, what kind of cases are they involved with?
Yeah, great question. So in 2004, right? Check my date on that, but when, you know, the United States invaded Iraq and we took control of that territory, right? You guys all remember that there was a massive looting event at the Iraqi National Museum, a really terrible, right? Terrible event. And, you know, you might understand that the Army, of course, they're not trained to do law enforcement, right? So you have a bunch of young men and women that stood there and watched this happen, and nobody really knew what they should do. So you had this terrible crime that was committed, and at the time, you know, that was on us, right? That was on the United States to make that right, to fix it. And so, as I said, Congress kind of looked around, not just at the FBI, they looked at multiple agencies within our system. But, you know, the kind of the overarching question is, what are you guys going to do to make this right? How are you going to investigate it? How are you going to fix it? And so at the time, the FBI had a few agents across the workforce that were kind of just working art crime cases ad hoc on the side. And that was maybe because they had some personal interest or some background, some expertise, right, that they would bring to the table. But there was no formalized program. So the FBI realized that they needed a formalized program. We needed a dedicated team of agents that had specific skill sets. Because you might imagine when you're trying to investigate and recover high-value artworks or antiquities, antiques, rare books, manuscripts, whatever it might be in the cultural heritage space, it's not the same as seizing guns or drugs. You just don't come along, pick it up, throw it in a brown paper sack, slap an evidence sticker on it, and call it a day, right? I mean, some of these objects are thousands of years old. They require very specific care and handling, environmental controls, all kinds of things. And when we seize them, we now become responsible stewards of them, right? And it's our responsibility to preserve them and make sure that they're protected. And largely the same way that a museum might do that. And so that was the concept of the formation of this team. And so it was formed in late 2004, early 2005. And, you know, it was born from there. And it started quite small at the time. I think there were maybe 8 agents on the team. And that number persisted for years. When I came on the team about a year and a half, 2 years later, there were only 8 of us at the time. So you might imagine that it, within the law enforcement world, art and cultural property crime is fairly low on the priority list. When you consider all the other things that, you know, the FBI has to investigate, you know, whether it's terrorism or human trafficking or cybercrime or whatever, right? A lot of other priorities that take up the Bureau's interest and time. So, you know, it took this dedicated team, right, of just kind of really passionate agents that really wanted to do the work and understood why we did the work. And so the team was, you know, kind of small at its beginning. And when I took over the program in 2016, we really spent quite a bit of time working to grow the program, build its its reputation, if you will, within the organization, but just its impact, right? And the type of cases that we were working and the number of cases. And so at the height of the program, I think I had it up to as many as 23 agents. And so we had tripled our caseload, tripled our budget, and we were quite busy. Now, to answer your question about kind of what the team does, you know, most people, I think, intuitively would understand, you know, they when they think about the FBI's art crime team, they want to think about chasing stolen Picassos and stolen Van Goghs around. And we certainly do that work. But to dispel any myths or notions on that, right, that really represents a fairly small part of the portfolio of the work we do. So theft cases, you know, the numbers vary slightly, but let's call that 25% of the caseload. 25 to 30% of the caseload is somehow related to theft. And it's not, particularly in the United States, it's not these Hollywood type, you know,
French cat burglars or something.
It's not the Italian job kind of stuff. It's mostly, you know, lowbrow kind of crimes of opportunity, you know, pilfers and, you know, internal theft, that kind of stuff that we see here in the United States. Those Hollywood style crimes tend to be a European problem. We see that much more in Europe. We don't see that really too much in the United States. But we don't just do theft cases, right? We do fraud cases, forgery cases, antiquities trafficking, money laundering, sanctions evasion, you name it. The list goes on. It's quite a broad program. As far as the material, you know, we're talking about fine art, antiquities, rare books, manuscripts. We even do collectibles. You know, I did a presentation at the Smithsonian a couple of weeks ago, and they made me tell the story about recovering Tom Brady's Super Bowl jersey. You know, so we do some kind of strange things from time to time, you know, that but I think our view of it, it was always, if it has today or is likely to have in the future some cultural impact, it belongs in our program and we want to work it. It's fascinating because when there's a theft, the very first question that most people ask, not only the media, the press, but even within the FBI, FBI executives, the very first question they always asked me when there was a theft and there was a crime was, what's it worth? You know, I hate that question. And I would usually just kind of shrug at people and say, well, you take your pick. It's either priceless or it's worthless. I'm not, I was usually pretty reluctant to assign some monetary value to a piece that had been stolen or lost, because we look more at the cultural significance of the piece, right? Not what its market value is. We wanted to understand its importance.
Yeah. A few things on that. How does an art crime investigation kind of typically unfold, sort of from the first lead to recovery of stolen artifacts? Because you were saying, obviously, when you recover an artifact, now you become the kind of custodians of it, which is quite different from regular evidence.
Yeah. So that's a big question, right? That's a very difficult, it's a hard one to answer because I hate to give you the cliche answer, but every case is different, right? And they truly are different. Every case has its own individual fingerprint. Now, you can broadly categorize cases a certain way, right? So a theft case is kind of the whodunit, right? That's the traditional law enforcement case where we're going to come in and we're going to establish a crime scene investigation. We're going to do forensic analysis. We're going to do open source intelligence, geofencing, all of these things, these traditional law enforcement tools that we're going to apply to that crime in order to figure out who did it, right? But now on theft cases, this is one thing I talk about. We train our new art crime agents on this considerably, is this concept of what's the priority on a theft case. And so if I were to ask you what you think the number one priority is for me as an investigator, if I'm working on the theft of an object, is it the arrest and conviction of the subject? Because that's fairly traditional, right? Normally, law enforcement, that's what they're focused on. They want to identify the bad guy. They want to arrest the bad guy and successfully prosecute, right, the bad guy. And I say on art theft cases, yeah, we want to do those things, but they're probably not my primary consideration. My primary consideration is the safe recovery of the artwork, right? So we treat them more like a kidnapping investigation, a kidnapping for ransom, right? We're more concerned about the safe recovery of that object or that artwork than we are about, you know, arresting the bad guy, if you will. Now, we want to do that, right? Don't misunderstand. We definitely want to do that. We want to hold people accountable. But sometimes you have to sacrifice that in order to be successful at recovering the artwork. So that's really a unique thing related to art theft cases that you might not see with traditional criminal cases. But now, if we're talking about fraud cases, those tend to be much more of a paper case, if you will. Generally not a whodunit. We usually know who the players are as we enter into an investigation. And so it's more just about conducting a paper case, lots of interviews, understanding the nature of the fraud, and then going about our business of trying to prove the fraud, right? Prove the knowledge element of that crime. So again, it's a hard question to answer with specificity, but to give you some sense of, we approach them from maybe two different directions, right? Depending on the type of the investigation.
Yeah. I had my own encounter very tangentially with the art crime team. I think it was about 2010. I was doing some research for a documentary that sadly never got made about the art loss register in London. And as we were interviewing, I think it was Julian was the man who we were interviewing. He had a secondary phone start ringing, and it was a BlackBerry that had been issued to him by the FBI. And he had to sort of pause our conversation to have a chat with the FBI about some case he was helping with. So how does the art crime team kind of work with international partners? What kind of organizations do they work with?
Oh, all of them, yeah, is the very short answer to that, right? So you can imagine art crime is like most crime. It's transnational, right? And in fact, within the FBI's hierarchy, it falls within the Transnational Organized Crime Program at the FBI. And that's just a recognition of that transnational nature of that crime trend. You know, criminals know no borders, and the United States is the largest consumer of art in the world. The numbers again vary, but we bear somewhere around 42-43% of the global art market. Now that's the licit market and the illicit market, right? So we have a lot of wealth in this country, so a lot of stolen antiquities and stolen artworks and these kinds of things tend to come to our region. So you can imagine we're not just focused on domestic cases within the United States, right? We do a fair amount of work, and I would say probably at least 50% of our work is related to working with our international partners, whether that's helping to recover objects that have migrated into the U.S. from a foreign partner, or if it's we're chasing our objects in those foreign markets, right, and working those investigations. So, yeah, you know, a lot of country specific, particularly rather, across the European Union, they have their own art crime units, right? So, of course, the Italian Carabinieri have the largest in the world. The TPC in Italy, you know, their numbers are quite large. I think they've got around 300 folks assigned to work in art crime. No one else in the world even comes close to that. That just, you know, I think signifies how important it is to the Italians, right? That they want to protect their culture, mm-hmm, heritage. Mm-hmm. But we see teams across the width and breadth of not only the EU, but they're of course in you know, the Middle East and Southeast Asia, and we've got a few teams in South America that we work with. So we work closely with those organizations. We, you know, the FBI works with Interpol, Europol, but not just within law enforcement community, right? We're also working with, you know, like the foreign version of the U.S. State Department. We're working with foreign service folks, with other museums, you know, Ministry of Culture professionals, those kinds of folks. And then we rely heavily on, you know, academia and, you know, the art world itself, right, to guide our investigations.
Yeah. And have the FBI been sort of brought in by foreign sort of governments or organizations for help, just to kind of help them investigate a crime? Because I know there's been a big, there was a big art theft earlier this year at a museum in Eastern Europe, and I've forgotten where it was at the moment, but I was trying to look it up while you were chatting, but I couldn't find it. But do they ever get sort of brought in as kind of consultants as well?
Yeah, I think that has happened, you know, fairly frequently. Of course, in my time in the FBI, we spent quite a bit of time and energy providing training across the globe, right? We were going over and training a lot of our foreign partners on, not, you know, not only on what we've learned over the years, but also it was a great opportunity for us to learn from them as well, right? It's a great opportunity to collaborate and share experience. Yeah. So, and then from time to time, we would do, you know, consulting, and particularly, you know, if there was some nexus, if you will, to the United States, then they might bring us on to do a cooperative, you know, investigation.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, I want to quickly ask a bit about sort of organized crime and art theft, because apparently organized crime groups and even extremist networks are drawn to art and antiquities theft. So is it about money, or is there something more strategic at play with that?
Well, that's another difficult, big question you're asking there, right? Right, it's fascinating that to think that organized crime does play such a large role in art crime, and that's certainly the case, right? Particularly in the United States, I'd say in the 1980s were the heyday of the mob here related to art crime. So we look across the width and breadth of many of our museum heists back in those days. Most of those were related to the mob or to organized crime in some shape or fashion. So, you know, whether it was monetary or not, I mean, it's always monetary, right? You know, I think the goal is to try to monetize the commodity. And, you know, one of my old colleagues, I'm going to coin his phrase, he would always say the art and art crime was trying to move the artwork right after it's stolen. So when we look at a theft case, that tends to be the most difficult part. Stealing it's not necessarily the hard part. It's what do you do with it after you steal it? And so that's, you don't really see a lot of successful art thieves in the world, because once they've stolen the artwork, we don't know what to do. It's, you know, everybody knows if you steal the Mona Lisa, everybody in the world knows it's stolen, right? So you're going to have a hard time moving that object, right? And so if you do move it, you're going to move it in the black market, which means you're dealing with other criminals, which means you're going to get pennies on the dollar. So you don't get market value. This concept of I'm going to steal a $10 million painting and I'm going to turn around and sell it for $10 million is nonsense, right? Because it's just not how it works. So, you know, this concept of targeted theft, again, it's kind of a dying thing. We don't see it much these days, particularly with, technology has improved tenfold, right, for security apparatuses and these kinds of things. It's just making it more difficult for thieves to target artworks. Not to say it doesn't happen. Again, we see a lot more of that in Europe than we see here in the United States. But, you know, you asked about terrorism. Of course, we saw, you know, throughout the 2013, 2014, those time frames where ISIS and Al-Qaeda were, you know, very publicly destroying world monument sites. And then maybe a little less publicly, they were looting and stealing some of those pieces, right, to put them into the into the market, right, to monetize those. And so it was just that was a you know, an opportunity for them to take that commodity and monetize it, right, to fund their terrorist operations. So we do see that from time to time. You know, this book, Don Miller, I think he was kind of the antithesis to all of that, right? This concept of the kind of the Thomas Crown Affair, you know, movie ideology that people have, where you got this eccentric billionaire is going to steal an artwork just so he can, you know, appreciate it and sit and stare at it in his office. We don't see that, right? That's pretty unusual. I won't say it never happens, but it's really unusual to see a case like that. But Don Miller was that type of case, right? Don, his looting activities and his collecting activities were very deeply personal for him, right? That was, I won't suggest he never sold or traded. He certainly did. If he had too many of one type of object, he might trade for something else or he might sell it. But in general, his goal was for personal enjoyment. So he was not selling his collection. He was gathering these items so that he could just sit and you know, look at them, which is pretty unusual.
Why is art theft so big in Europe then in comparison to the US? Is it because it's easier to shift it, or is it something else?
I think I want to be thoughtful how I answer that question.
Okay.
So your institutions in Europe tend to be far older, right? So they have some just some basic infrastructure differences that we do have in the United States. Maybe it's a little slower to upgrade security apparatus. Population density is a factor, right? It's much easier to move across borders in Europe. You know, I have a lot of European friends and colleagues, of course, that when they come to the United States, they kind of get their mind blown when they realize, you know, it would take them 3 days to drive from, you know, the East Coast to the West Coast. And we're a much bigger nation, and we have quite a, you know, we have a lot more law enforcement agencies here, right? So I think our number is somewhere around 15,000 police agencies in the United States. And no one else on the planet has that. So I think there's just a host of factors that contribute to that. Organized crime is a little more active, right? These organized crime groups are a bit more active across the EU than they are in the US, and they're just, you know, they just specialize in different things, right? Every kind of organized crime group has their own crime specialty, and in Europe it tends to be art. You know, I think there are more factors, but I'd want to be, you know, careful about what I said on that. So,
okay, fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. Well, thank you very much for that. Let's take a break and be right back with more.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
So turning to your book, The Grave Robber, who was Don Miller and what made his collection so sort of extraordinary and disturbing?
Yeah, well, I hesitate to use the word fascinating because I don't want to necessarily paint Don in any kind of a positive light, but just, you know, stepping back from it, Don really was this fascinating character when you think about, you know, not just this horrific collection that he had amassed, and I'll talk about that, but just looking at him historically. Here was a man who, you know, again, is, you know, born in the 20s. He came up, of course, he was a young man at the outset of World War II. And so he's part of that generation, right? Even that itself is just fascinating to understand the history of that, where he came up at the beginning of World War II. But he was a quite brilliant man. So he had a PhD, and I think it was electrical engineering. I think he had a couple of master's degrees. He was quite accomplished academically. And he was part of the Manhattan Project. So he worked on Oppenheimer's team as they were developing the first atom bomb at Los Alamos. Now, some of this is fact versus fiction. It gets a little bit nebulous to try to figure out what's true with Don, because he was very prone to embellishing and creating stories. Okay. And sometimes it can be very difficult to parse the truth out of those stories. But Don liked to tell everybody, and he told me several times, that he was the man who fired the first atom bomb at the Trinity site. Now, I don't believe that that's true, but it just gives you this look into his mindset. And so he was part of the team that developed a radio firing system. So his specialty was in radios and transmitting radio waves and images via radio waves. But he liked to tell this crazy story. Like he was out at the truck with another guy outside the bunker. They pushed a button and then it had run back into the bunker before the blast wave hit him, kind of thing. He even had a couple of photos of him sitting in this truck, you know, when he was a young man. So it was just an interesting backstory on him that just kind of lends to this, you know, persona that he had. But, you know, he comes out of the Manhattan Project. He stays with Oppenheimer. He's part of the team that goes to the Bikini Atoll and they're doing hydrogen bomb testing. You know, he worked for, I believe it was the Atomic Energy Commission for a while, and did a lot of work for the government during those years. Then he becomes a college professor for a while, and he's doing some of those things. So he was just really an accomplished guy. He had some patents. He had developed a system that allowed them to communicate with the astronauts at the space station, like the Mir space station, via video waves that he had developed. He was just this really fascinating character. And the local community, right? He lived in this tiny little rural county in the middle of nowhere in Indiana, just an hour or so out southeast of Indianapolis. And so you imagine cornfields and soybean fields and this kind of just a really nice, small, closed-knit community. that he lived in. And so he was pretty well known in that community as a philanthropist. I think he had some, you know, some minor wealth. He had a little bit of money and owned quite a bit of property down there. And so everybody knew him, and he had this brilliant reputation as just this philanthropist, just this nice guy who was community driven. And he was a missionary. And so he was known for going into foreign countries and doing missionary work, building churches and this kind of thing. Now, what they didn't know, right, this is kind of the Jekyll and Hyde thing going on with Miller, was what they didn't know is, well, yeah, he needed the missionary cover to get visas to go into these countries so that he could loot their archaeological sites, right? So he would build churches during the week, and on the weekends, he would go and loot archaeological sites or burial sites, right?
Yeah. Wow. That's some dedication there.
Yeah. Well, you know, clever. And then he would secret some of these objects and these artifacts that he looted on to government flights occasionally and get them back into the United States on government flights. That's what he was well known for in the community, was just being this philanthropist and, you know, kind of a missionary and these kinds of things. And so you can imagine the public reaction to the FBI's investigation of Don and the seizure of all this material didn't go very well for the local population, right? They didn't really understand. And I think people were fairly angry that we came along, and they called me everything under the sun at the time. But, you know, I think that's normal and it's natural when there's a vacuum and people don't understand all of the facts, right? They're going to fill that vacuum with their own opinions. But the reality of it was Don was a grave robber. You know, he was going all across the United States, but he was visiting the rest of the world and was actively looting burial sites and burial caves and stealing bodies and taking their possessions and bringing them home. So that's the truth of Don.
Yeah, what kind of possessions was he taking?
Oh, you name it. His collection was really eclectic. He had about 42,000 objects in his collection is what our final count was. Now, you know, look, to be clear, some of that, much of that were arrowheads, pottery shards, these types of things, right, which kind of inflate the numbers. But half of that was legitimate museum quality, you know, full pieces. So there was a lot of pottery, as you might imagine, particularly Native American pottery that he was, you know, looting from around the United States. But he had all kinds of memorabilia, though. He had some Revolutionary War stuff, Civil War, World War II memorabilia. You know, he had fossils. He would collect anything that was even remotely related to cultural heritage or, you know, paleontological specimens, those kinds of things. So he was collecting all of that. But he didn't, you know, focus on one specific indigenous group or one culture, right? He was pretty eclectic. He was collecting anything he could get his hands on.
Yeah. And what was his sort of motivation then for this collection? What was he sort of doing?
Unusually, his goal was not monetary in nature, right? He wasn't trying to loot and steal and collect these objects to turn around and sell. His goal was very deeply personal. And so he shared with me a couple of times that it was a heroin addiction for him. He described it like a heroin addiction, that he just couldn't stop doing it. So I think he was just deeply obsessed with it. And he had some, you know, I'm no psychologist. I want to be careful about, you know, asserting any kind of, you know, psychological disorders or any of that kind of thing. But there were some strange things going on. Like, we seized a lot of his home movies and his own personal photos. And he would do weird things, like dig up a grave and lay down in the grave with the body. And, you know, it was really deeply disturbing stuff that he was doing. And I'll let you and your listener formulate your own opinions of that. Again, it's not for me to diagnose him with anything or suggest that he had any kind of a mental issue, but it was just some deeply disturbing behavior when he was digging up bodies. You know, it was always with a smile on his face, and he was ear-to-ear grins. And like I said, he would get down and lay in the graves with him. It was really bizarre and disturbing.
Yeah, yeah. It sounded a bit like he hid a lot of what he was doing quite well. What was he sort of like as a person? How did he make you feel when you were sort of chatting with him and stuff? What was he like?
Super nice, affable. Of course, you know, when we finally interacted with Don, he was, you know, he was pretty advanced in age. He was 91 at the time that I met him the first time. So, you know, as you might imagine, was a bit frail, was very soft-spoken. You had to really pay attention to listen to be able to hear him, because he had a really soft, raspy voice. But 91, he was still quite spry. He was up moving about. He wanted to talk about the collection. He was very happy to show me around. Even though he knew I was an FBI agent, he didn't really fully understand why I was there. You know, the simple ruse that we had told him was that I was just an enthusiast. I collected and I heard about his collection. Can I just come in and take a look at it? So he was more than happy to bring me in, and, you know, he had a lot of energy, spent a lot of time with us, walked us around the whole collection, showed everything off, told me lots and lots of stories about how he had collected these things. But he was, you know, he was still very intelligent. That was the thing that you were most impressed with, Don, at the end was, you know, at 91 years old, and though in frail health, intellectually, he was still sharp as a tack, right? And so very impressive man on that front. But, you know, Don also knew, I think, deep down, you know, that what he had done was wrong, was criminal and morally objectionable. So he was also very careful about what he would say about certain things. If it were the inanimate objects, right, the pottery, the shards, you know, the beads, whatever it might be, he was pretty talkative about that stuff. But of course, importantly, none of the human remains were out on display in his little museum, nor did he share any of that with us up front. I think that was, you know, very intentional.
Yeah. Well, how was he treating the human remains then in comparison to the pottery?
It was horrible, deeply offensive, terrible conditions. And so, you know, if you can imagine, he's got this large home. And his large home is one of several buildings on this property. He's on about 10 acres proper and several hundred acres of a, you know, farm. But, you know, kind of the homestead, if you will, was on about 10 acres. And so he had his new home. I say new, it was probably built in the 70s. But then there was the old farmhouse where he had grown up, was still on that property. And there was another building where he did like his home business out of that building. And then there were several barns and some outbuildings. And so everywhere on the property, we were finding objects and human remains. But your question was about the human remains and the conditions. Horrifying and not what we expected. We thought, you know, well, we knew we had some because the tipsters had told us as much and some family members had you know, kind of during interviews had told us a little about some of these remains. So, but I think we expected to find a dozen, you know. I think that's probably accurate to what we had conceived in our head. Maybe we'll find a dozen sets of remains, but we found hundreds, you know, 2,000 bones. And so if you can imagine, you're going into a barn and there's all these old rotten cardboard boxes up on the shelves covered in cobwebs and, you know, everything, bugs and everything else. But you'd open up these boxes, they would be full of bones. Or we'd go in the basement and there were dozens of tote bins and you'd pull the lids off of these tote bins and it would be full of human skulls or human bones. It was, you know, we found a garbage bag, like one of these big 50-gallon garbage bags down in his bomb shelter under a shelf. And it was closed. And so when we opened it up, a raccoon came running. That's the thing. Scared everybody half to death. But anyway, we open up this garbage bag and it's full of people. And, you know, it's a really horrifying way that we were finding human beings. And which, you know, I think you're hitting on a really important point. So if you go into his museum, this little basement museum, and all of the artifacts, all of these inanimate objects had prized positions, and they were shelved, and they were nicely displayed, and they had placards, and they were treated with some level of care. But none of the ancestral remains from the Native Americans or foreign cultures, it wasn't just Native American, none of these human beings that he had dug up were treated with any respect whatsoever. They were thrown in garbage bags and boxes and it's, you know, tells you everything you need to know, right? So
yeah. Well, what do you think this story then reveals about these sort of mid-century attitudes towards sort of collecting archaeology and these indigenous remains?
Well, I'll quote the section I wrote in the book, and people have heard me say this before, you know, when I've talked about this case publicly. The most impactful moment that I had in this entire investigation for me personally, just as a self-awareness moment, right, where I had to kind of face some of my own, you know, upbringing and some of my own views of the world and my culture, was the first day of our actual seizure. You know, the first day was really just set up, get some sense of what we're dealing with, understand the full scope of the collection. And we started to realize there were far more human beings there in his house than we had anticipated. So we had to change our operational strategy a little bit because they were our priority, right? Recovering human remains, of course, becomes our number one priority in this case. And so so the first day was just dedicated to setting up, you know, redrawing the map a little bit, figuring out our operational plan. But on day two of this operation, we started actively recovering human remains. And about halfway through that day, Don came to me and he was kind of agitated. And he stopped and he was questioning me about, well, I thought you guys were here to take the pots and to take, you know, the beads and all these other things. And he paused. He's like, why are you taking all of my Indians? And I just kind of looked at Don. And you have to remember, we're there on consent, right? We had a search warrant, but we didn't execute the warrant because he consented through his legal counsel. He voluntarily allowed us to come in and seize the property. He wanted to cooperate. But when you're on consent, you know, anyone can revoke consent at any moment, right? And so you just have to kind of play this game a little bit. Well, we got to treat them very delicately, right? Because we don't want to do anything that's going to disrupt this balance and provoke them into revoking consent. And then we've got to switch to the warrant. This creates all kinds of legal hassle for us. So we have to be nice to Don, right? You got to put your best face on and deal with him with kid gloves. But he came to me and he's like, I don't understand why you're taking my Indians. And I just remember looking at Don and saying, well, you know, Don, you know, the human remains in your house and your property are our number one priority. And, you know, some people might find what you've done to be horrible, right? Be fairly offensive. Like you went and stole these people, you dug them up out of their graves. And you could just see the look on his face. He didn't really understand where I was coming from. And he said, I'm quoting the book where he said to me, well, if it's just a bunch of dead Indians that make you squeamish, then go ahead and take them. And it was just really insulting. I mean, it was for me, it was just like getting punched in the gut because I thought, you know, we like to throw the word racism around a lot these days. I think most of the time it's misunderstood and poorly used. But in that moment in time with Don, that was the moment I was like, this is what real racism looks like. This is what it is. Because to him, these Native Americans, and there were other cultures represented in the human remains, but to Don, they weren't human beings. These were things. They had no more moral equivalency than the rock did or the pot down in the basement. They were just, and so, you know, I had this reaction. I thought, just my God, I can't believe you just said that to me, like just a bunch of dead Indians, you know, kind of thing. So it's the only time I kind of lost my cool with Don, and I just retorted back that, well, if that's the way you feel about it, Don, then you don't mind if I go down to the cemetery and dig up your grandparents and I'll take them home and stick them up on my, you know, thing. And that pissed him off. He got mad and he turned around in a huff and he walked away. But, you know, it was just like, that's the root of the question you asked me, though, because for Don Miller and those like Don, going down and digging up white people out of the cemetery is morally objectionable and wrong. But to go and dig up indigenous peoples and treat them like objects was totally fine. And this is a big part of what I'm trying to get across in the book, is it's not fine. And this behavior is completely unacceptable. And we should not, as a culture, stand for that kind of behavior.
Yeah, indeed.
Don Miller, his attitudes towards collecting and archaeology was also quite fascinating, because Don considered himself, and many in his little small community considered him to be this amateur archaeologist, right? Which is fascinating, because when you look at his home, his personal movies and his photographs of his digging activities, they're just digging looter pits, right? This is not archaeology. Mm-hmm. This is not carefully prescribed and documented and fully mapped archaeological test pits and understanding, right? They're not, they don't understand context. They're not trying to do any kind of academic evaluation of this, just digging looter pits. And half the time they were in there with bulldozers and backhoes. And pretty sure I don't know any archaeologist that conduct an archaeological examination with a backhoe, you know, not the way that they were doing it. And so, and, you know, it was interesting because Don authored a couple of books himself, I think back in the 50s and 60s, maybe they were a long time ago, but he wrote and published a couple of really small volumes on amateur archaeology. So he really considered himself to be some kind of quasi-archaeologist when in fact he's just a looter. So if you look at satellite imagery of Palmyra today in Syria, and you see what it looked like before ISIS took over, and then you see what it looked like after, you see all the hundreds of looter pits that dot the landscape around that archaeological site. That's not archaeology, right? That's looting. And so when you look at Don digging in South Dakota or in New Mexico, his looter pits look just like the ones in Syria, right? So let's just dispel any notion that this is archaeology. This is looting and nothing more.
Yeah. And I think, you know, touching on the kind of racial angle, I think the problem is with somebody like Don, because he's doing it, he probably thinks he has a right to do it. And some people don't realize that what they're doing is wrong. It's yeah, in this sort of strange, warped way.
So, well, this used to be somewhat of a national pastime in the United States, right? This concept of pot hunting, going out, particularly in the rural Southwest region of the United States, it still happens today. It's fairly commonplace, but it used to be a bit of a national pastime. And so anytime I talk to these, well, I'll use the loose term pot hunter. I know that they don't like that term, but that's kind of the way that it's used. But they all possess the same kind of mentality as you just touched on, that they're actually preserving history in some way. They think that by going in and digging up these sites, particularly on the riverbanks, they're preserving these things from being lost, right? As rivers rise and erosion happens and these kinds of things, that these sites might get destroyed. That's fine and great, but it never seems to occur to them that that wasn't the intended outcome, particularly for burial sites, right? So if you pass away and you're buried, your loved ones bury you with the understanding of there you are, right? And somebody's not going to come along and dig you up and pull you out of there. And so it's this really fascinating look in the psychology of the looting and the pot hunting, where they think that they're somehow protecting it, and it never occurs to them that no one wanted them to protect it, right? It's a human dignity issue, and these folks should be left alone where they were buried.
Let's take a break and be right back with more.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
So how do agencies sort of work with indigenous and international kind of communities to repatriate sacred or ancestral objects respectfully?
It's a difficult landscape. So we talk about that a lot with the Don Miller investigation and I talk about it in this book, that, you know, this massive operation to recover thousands and thousands of objects and, you know, a couple of thousand human bones, that was a monumental task, right? It was the largest such operation the Bureau had ever done. But let's be clear, that was just the beginning, right? That was really the easy part of this investigation. Once we collect this material, now, as I suggested at the beginning, we're stewards of it. It's our responsibility to protect it and maintain it. It's not just evidence. You don't go stick it in the evidence locker. We had to build a warehouse. You know, well, I say we built it. We leased a warehouse and then we had it converted to our use, right? We had to adapt it to do environmental controls, climate control, you know, manage the temperature and the humidity property based on the artifacts. We have to preserve and collect it, right? We don't want to be in a situation where the FBI collects these things. You take a pot that's 5,000 years old that survived looting, survived Don, survived being in his house for 60 years, that we come along and we destroy it, right? So we want to make sure that we're not in a position to do that. But then the real work begins, right? This work of classifying these objects, of culturally affiliating them, understand the authentic ones, right? Because inevitably there's always going to be a fake or two. And there were in this case, right? We did encounter a few fakes through the collection, which is not surprising, but there's just an awful lot of work. And you can imagine the various disciplines that have to come in, right, that we had to bring in and to do this. But there is no one expert, right? You can't look at a collection like his that's this eclectic and represents so many broad cultures across the globe and find an expert. That's not reality, right? So the truth is it takes lots and lots of experts, and in our case, hundreds of experts that we had to consult with over the years. Just try to build consensus, because there's not always agreement, right, necessarily on cultural affiliation for an object. And you might imagine modern day borders create challenges for cultures that existed 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago that predate these modern borders, right? It can be quite a challenge at times, and trying to figure out ownership, right? If you've got some Aztec object from South America, well, does it belong to Peru or does it belong to Ecuador, right? That those things can become a challenge. And like specifically, we had recovered some Tibetan Kapala, which are human skulls that have been cut open. These were donors, if you will. These were tended to be volunteers. It was considered an honor to do this, but they're turned into, they adorn them with jewels and gold, and these times they turn them into basically bowls that you can drink wine out of, and those kinds of things. And they're ceremonial in nature, but they are human remains. But we had recovered a few of these from Dawn, but they're from Tibet. Well, that you can just imagine the political and diplomatic challenges related to returning that. Do we return them to the exiled government of Tibet, or do we return them to China, who annexed Tibet? Right. Yeah. And so it gets to be, there are some challenges, right, that you have to navigate as you're doing these repatriation processes. Sometimes it's super easy and really straightforward. Sometimes it's not based on politics, right? If we've got objects for a country that maybe we don't have diplomatic relationships with, or these kinds of things that we had to be very careful. Then on the Native American side of things, domestically in the United States, if you think about this, right, there are 500 and I don't know what the exact number is today, somewhere 584 federally recognized Native tribes in the United States. Each one of those is a sovereign nation. And so we have to have government-to-government relationships with those and government-to-government consultation. So you think about that for a minute. That's almost triple the size of the UN. And when have you ever seen the United Nations have complete agreement on anything, right? And now you triple that, right? So you can imagine some of the challenges that we encounter trying to do cultural affiliation for objects that are Native American, right? And particularly if we don't necessarily know where the object came from. And that was the case in many of the examples with the Miller investigation, is he wasn't very good at keeping records. And so there were lots of challenges with that. So patience and perseverance is the key. And I think what we did differently in this case, particularly with the Native American community, is instead of treating them like a victim and just telling them, this is what we're going to do, we'll talk to you at the end. That was not my method. So we brought the tribal community into this case day one. Even before we were on Miller's property, we were already consulting with the tribal community. We had tribal representatives on scene with us, which is a stark departure from our typical policy. But we knew that it was necessary because their ancestors are not evidence objects, right? They're people, they're human beings, and they have deep spiritual ties to the community, right? They have very deep spiritual beliefs. And, you don't want to come in and do a law enforcement operation to solve this problem, to try to make things right and inadvertently just make it worse, right? And so we were really keen on that to bring the tribal community in to guide us and give us the wisdom on how to deal with the ancestors and how to treat them with dignity and respect. And so, we had to adopt some alternative policies, if you will. We had to kind of deviate from some traditional policies and create some new plans and some new programs to deal with that. But we were pretty successful at it.
Excellent. I mean, how has the FBI sort of changed its approach to heritage crime since the Miller case?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. Like I, you know, I've said, this was really a seminal moment for us, and it was really a great opportunity for us to learn, particularly in dealing with the tribal community in the United States, because let's face it, historically, the FBI and the Native community in the U.S. have not had a very good relationship, right? And largely due to missteps the FBI has taken over the years. And so you could even look at a more recent example. It predates the Miller case, but the Cerebus Action case, is sometimes called the Three Corners case, was another big operation out in the Southwest, and it was a multi-agency investigation. And it was a good case. They did a great job of this investigation. They, too, were recovering thousands of Native American artifacts. But the difference in that case and this is that was multiple collectors spread across different states, and it was all just taken under one action. In our case, with the Miller case, this was one property, right, that housed all of this material. And with all respect to my colleagues that worked that investigation out there, they did a great job, but there were some missteps, right? They approached it from a traditional law enforcement perspective without any consideration for the community impact and the impact on the tribal community particularly. And it didn't go well. You know, there were some suicides that occurred and because of that investigation. Public backlash was pretty severe on that case. And so we knew that, okay, well, we need to rethink our way, right? Let's not step on some of those landmines. Let's rethink how we do this. And so our approach was, let's bring the community in at the beginning and work with them as collaborative partners and show them respect, and not treat them like a victim at the end. Let's treat them like partners. And so that's to answer your question, is we kind of then took that strategy and we've implemented that across the width and breadth of our cultural property protection programs. And so our, you know, other agencies have learned from that. And so we've spread that, you know, globally. We talked to our foreign partners about the successes that we had in this case and kind of how we manage those relationships.
Mm. I just wanted to ask, if I may, with obviously the FBI is now being sort of undergoing recent changes, what do you think the future of the art crime team looks like?
Yeah, well, I'm nervous for the team. I mean, let's be clear, change is the only constant in the FBI. You know, it's been around for over 110 years. In terms of the United States, it's an old agency. Now, in Europe, it's still we're still a youth, but here it's a fairly old agency, and so. It's not unusual for the FBI to change priorities. That happens probably once a decade. You know, if it, you know, after 9/11, it was all things terrorism. And then, you know, in the 80s, it was all organized crime. You know, we've had our era of healthcare fraud. You know, we do shift priorities frequently, right? That's what the FBI does, is shift to focus on emerging crime trends and where our threats lie today. So there has been a shift at FBI headquarters. In fact, sadly, my position, the program manager position that I held at the FBI, doesn't exist anymore. That position is now folded up into other priorities. So there's no headquarters component at the moment, but it'll be okay because there wasn't a headquarters component, you know, 20 years ago either. And so I suspect that as the government, as the FBI focuses on its current problems, it will eventually make its way back to addressing some of these. And I mean, the good news is the art crime team still exists in the field. And so the agents on the team are still in the field. They're still working great investigations. They're still passionate about the program. I have the utmost faith that they're going to continue to carry that flag and do good by not only the U.S., you know, U.S. citizens, but globally as well, right? They're going to keep the fight up. So I'm very proud of that team.
Yeah, thank you for that. So finally then, what do you hope readers will take away from The Grave Robber about sort of justice, memory, and our responsibility to the past?
The big takeaway for me is I hope people actually start to face this issue, realize that it exists, and then stand up and say it's not okay, right? Collectively as a people, as human beings, we should strongly object to this cultural exploitation that continues to happen. This is some really fascinating thing about the human condition, where we feel like if we, if we're the winner, if there's a conflict and we win, we somehow have the right to go in and destroy that other culture's history. And it's not okay to do that. And so I want readers to understand that this looting continues today. This is not some 200-year-old problem or 1,000-year-old problem. It's a today problem. And that we should stand up and say we're not going to take it, right? We're not going to accept that. And I would challenge people to look at their own view of manifest destiny and what that means, and you know what racism really means. That's and you know my hope is that we're giving these indigenous communities a voice in this book.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Well, Tim, thank you for joining me today. Where can listeners find out more about you and your excellent book?
Yeah. So thanks for that. So, I'm retired from the FBI now. And so I formed a company, and I work with a lot of my great friends and colleagues. And so our company is Argus Cultural Property Solutions. So you can find us at arguscpc.com. My book goes on sale in 4 days on October 14th. And so, of course, you can get that on Amazon. You can get it on Barnes & Noble, any of your major booksellers, or find it in hard copy at your local bookstore.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for joining me today. It's really been an enjoyable chat today. So thank you.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.